KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. French President Emmanuel Macron has a big task today. Convince President Trump not to sideline Europe as he works to cut a deal with Russia 3 years after its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Israeli tanks are deployed in the occupied West Bank for the first time in over two decades. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Palestinians fear the tanks are a precursor for Israel to annex the territory. Also, a South African cellist on mixing classical influences with improvisation on his new album. Plus, getting away from our phones, shocking, is a good thing. It's Monday, February 24th, which is when the Supreme Court back in 1803 ruled that judges have the power to strike down laws when they conflict with the Constitution. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A dozen world leaders are in Ukraine's capital today to mark 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv. Ukraine's president is seeking to unite European leaders as the Trump administration moves toward restoring U.S. ties with Russia.
Speaking to reporters on Sunday, Zelensky said he's planning a European summit related to ending the war. Zelensky says he wants a European representative at the negotiating table along with the U.S., Russia, and Ukraine. He also said he is still working on a deal with the United States that could exchange hundreds of billions of dollars of critical raw materials for security guarantees. He rejected earlier versions of the deal because the terms would leave Ukraine deeply in debt. He said, "I am not signing something that 10 generations of Ukrainians will have to repay." Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
Germany held national elections over the weekend. The mainstream conservative party won the largest share of votes. The party's leader, Friedrich Merz, says he'll quickly form a government. But Esme Nicholson reports in Berlin, a far-right German party got the second largest share of the votes.
Merz's Christian Democrats will be able to uphold what is often referred to as the firewall against the far-right Alternative für Deutschland Party, or AfD, by partnering with just one party, according to the provisional election result. AfD leader Alice Weidel says that Merz must respect the will of the electorate and take up her offer to govern together. Merz is expected to seek a coalition with outgoing Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democrats. Merz told voters on Sunday night that the world is not waiting for Germany and that his top priority is to unify and strengthen Europe, calling Vice President J.D. Vance and Elon Musk's support of the AfD as outrageous as interventions from Moscow. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson. In Berlin.
Jury selection starts today in North Dakota in a lawsuit filed against environmental activist group Greenpeace. The company, Energy Transfer, is suing Greenpeace for $300 million. This is over environmental protests led by Native Americans nearly a decade ago against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Officials at the company claim Greenpeace and other activists conspired to hurt the company. NPR's Jeff Brady reports Greenpeace says this lawsuit is intended to block free speech.
Greenpeace calls this a SLAP suit, and SLAP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. Essentially, a wealthy company takes a less wealthy critic to court, forcing them to spend time and money defending themselves rather than protesting. Greenpeace says the goal here is to win and dissuade other companies from filing cases like this.
NPR's Jeff Brady reporting. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Big tech company Apple has announced it will spend $500 billion in the U.S. over the next 4 years. Apple says it will expand facilities and teams in several states, from Michigan to Iowa to North Carolina. The company says it intends to focus on artificial intelligence and skills development for students. President Trump has already praised Apple online. Pope Francis remains hospitalized in critical condition. The Vatican says he is still being treated for severe pneumonia, and doctors now see signs of early kidney failure. They say that has been controlled. The Vatican says the Pope continues to rest. Conclave won the big prize at the Screen Actors Guild Awards last night. That's where top performances in film and TV were honored. Steve Futterman reports from Los Angeles.
On an evening where most of the winners were expected, there was one big surprise.
And the actor goes to Timothy Chalamet.
Timothy Chalamet won the award for Best Male Actor in a Leading Role for his portrayal of Bob Dylan in A Complete Unknown.
I'm really in pursuit of greatness. I know people don't usually talk like that, but I want to be one of the greats.
The favorite had been Adrian Brody for The Brutalist. Many SAG members are also Oscar members, so we may have gotten hints about who could win next week. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
The National Weather Service says an atmospheric river is pouring precipitation over the Pacific Northwest. There are winter storm warnings up for parts of central Washington state this morning. There is a risk of flooding. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, a look at how President Trump is realigning America's foreign policy. But first, President Donald Trump has dismissed several top military officials, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told Fox News Sunday why General Charles Q. Brown Jr. was ousted from his leadership job.
I have a lot of respect for C.Q. Brown. I got to know him over the course of a month. He's an honorable man, not the right man for the moment.
Joining us to discuss these developments is Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee. Senator, you've called these firings the beginning of a serious degradation of the military. What did you mean by that?
Well, this is unprecedented. These people were selected based on merit. They are seasoned professionals with many commands and range of experiences, and they were dismissed, I think, for political reasons. This administration wants to dominate the Department of Defense, then subservient to the president, not obedient to the Constitution, and that is profoundly wrong. And in addition to the firing of these general officers, the Secretary of Defense also fired the judge advocate generals of all the military services, which is a very shocking development. In fact, I think it signals the fact that he intends not to follow the law. If you're going to break the law, the first thing you do is get rid of the lawyers who will tell you about the law. So we're seeing an unprecedented transformation in common sense. It'll affect readiness, it'll affect recruitment, it'll affect retention, and it will be a disservice to the country.
And I want to ask you about that. Just one thing, though, on Charles Q. Brown. He had until September 2027 left in his term, so three more years, or at least 3 years into President Trump's final term as president. So why shouldn't a president, especially in President Trump's situation, not have his own leadership team around him for as long as he has left?
Well, one of the aspects of our professional military and one of the things that contributes to success is, one, individuals are chosen and married, and two, there's a sense of continuity that the military services are not agents of the president. They are protectors of the nation and the Constitution. And Trump and Hegseth have thrown that out the window. Not surprisingly, Trump is ignoring laws left and right. But this will have a serious impact on the military, very much so.
Now, we mentioned military readiness and trust the chain of command. How do these moves affect that?
Well, I think, frankly, there are a lot of people looking around now and saying, am I next? What do I have to do to avoid being terminated from my life's career? And I think the implication of all this, well, you better toe the party line and don't object to things and agree, even though you have your military opinion differs. So this will affect the whole body of the military, particularly the officer corps.
So you really think that the top military leaders would actually not tell the truth or at least speak their heart, even if they feel that something is not quite right, just to save their jobs?
Well, I think the principles of the military are such that they would want to do that. But again, you're putting on a significant new dynamic, which is if you don't say the right thing, you could be dismissed, or you could just simply just be dismissed because they just, for some reason, don't like you, regardless of your professional skills. And that's very troubling. It's indeed very troubling.
Now, when it comes to General Brown, was only the second black Joint Chiefs chairman, Navy Admiral Lisa Franchetti, first woman to lead a military service. How does that affect recruitment and retention?
Well, I think it has everyone shocked, and particularly officers who are minorities or females and enlisted personnel, too. The core of our military is non-commissioned officer corps, and many of those men and women are looking at this and saying, frankly, am I next? So this has a serious implication on recruitment and retention, as I said before.
All right, that's Senator Jack Reed, ranking Democrat on the Armed Services Committee. Senator, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
There's another consequential shakeup in play, and it's the U.S. about-face on Ukraine. Every day this week, we'll be exploring the repercussions of America's foreign policy reversals and realignments under President Trump with different writers, analysts, and leaders. Today, we focus on that shakeup involving America's global alliances. After years of U.S. policies to isolate Russia over its full-scale invasion, the Trump administration is ready to make a deal. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz held talks with Russian officials recently about a Russia-Ukraine peace deal, a meeting Ukrainian officials say they were not invited to attend. Meanwhile, President Trump is blaming Ukraine, a U.S. ally, for starting the war 3 years ago, which is just not true. So what does this mean for the U.S. and its traditional allies? Ann Applebaum has been writing on this at The Atlantic. Her most recent book is Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Rule the World. And welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So this about-face of U.S. policy and Trump seemingly aligning himself more closely with Russian President Vladimir Putin than European allies, what's most significant about this apparent shift?
For eight decades, U.S. foreign policy has been based on a network of alliances and institutions that allowed us to project power, to create zones of prosperity, to enjoy trade with like-minded partners, mostly in Europe and Asia, but also all over the world. What Trump is doing by signaling that he's no longer interested in hearing from European allies, that he's aligning with a power which I should say is daily threatening Europe. So there's both the war in Ukraine, there are frequent incidents of sabotage in the Baltic Sea, all over the continent. There are almost daily cyber attacks from Russian hacking groups. Russia is a present danger to Europeans. And for President Trump to say, I'm taking Putin's side, in other words, by repeating Russian propaganda about Ukraine, by seeming to want to end the war in a way that will not really end it, that will perhaps stop the fighting, but will not end Russia's, will not stop Russia from enacting its goal of destroying Ukraine completely eventually. By doing that, Trump is saying, I don't care anymore about alliances. I'm not interested in your opinions. I'm going to do a deal with this dictator over your head. And that's a message that is heard not just in every European capital, but in every allied capital around the planet as a sign that the U.S. is changing.
Okay, so if the U.S. says, I don't care about alliances anymore, what does that mean for U.S. and global stability?
It has so many implications that they're almost hard to think through. There are economic implications. You know, what happens to our trade relationships with Europe and with Asia? What about the U.S. companies that have enjoyed special favor in those markets? You know, U.S. defense companies, but also U.S. nuclear power companies, other kinds of big utility companies that have been welcomed by those countries because as a way of expressing their fealty to the United States. What happens to a series of trade agreements that have created easy and regular trade between all around the world? What happens to all kinds of treaties, treaties on not just treaties on commerce, but treaties on the laws of war? All these things that have governed U.S. behavior and allied behavior all over the world for 80 years now disappear.
So a potentially radical change of global alliances.
Very radical.
Journalist Anne Applebaum.
Pope Francis is still hospitalized in critical condition this morning. He's fighting double pneumonia. The Vatican says, quote, the night passed well and that the Pope slept and is resting. Earlier blood tests indicated signs of early kidney failure. On Sunday, Catholics around the world prayed for Francis's recovery. NPR's Ruth Sherlock went to one service at a cathedral in Rome.
Marie Cimarron, a thin woman who looks in her 60s, sits alone, her facial expression tense with sadness and fear. Pope Francis always has a kind prayer for everybody, she says. Now he really deserves so much thought and affection. Could these prayers help him, I ask? We turn to God, she says, becoming emotional. The Basilica of St. John Lateran, the oldest public church in Rome with its gold leaf ceilings and ornate statues, is packed for this special service for the Pope. You can feel the sadness here among the congregation. As people are praying, there are tears rolling down their cheeks. They are feeling this moment very deeply. The Pope has been hospitalized for over 10 days, during which time his condition has worsened. In a written message sent for the Sunday prayer at St. Peter's Square that he would usually attend, Pope Francis said he was continuing confidently with his treatment in hospital, and he posted on social media saying, quote, thank you for your closeness and for your consoling prayers. At the end of the evening service, as Stefano Danese leaves, he tells me these gatherings bring a feeling of brotherhood, of being united in this difficult moment. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
Catholic Church has been described as the world's last true monarchy. On the next Fresh Air, Philip Sheenan talks about the last seven popes and how efforts to reform the church with the Second Vatican Council led to power struggles and doctrinal debates that lasted for decades. Sheenan's book is Jesus Wept. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. NatGeoExpeditions.com/cruises. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. I think the best way to start this interview is just to let you listen. That is Abel Salauchue. And yes, that is a cello, and yes, he is playing it and singing, but he does a lot more. Composing, improvising, creating new relationships between genres and cultures. All of this comes together in his new album, Hymns of Bantu. Recently, he stopped by our studios to give us a sneak peek. He told me about how he first started playing the cello.
My brother actually was a really keen musician. He founded a music school, an outreach program in Soweto, and he just hauled me along with him. And he learned the system of the cello, you know, the four strings, you know, starting from A, D, G, and C. And he would write those on a piece of paper in lines. And you kind of would put a piece of paper on your chest or stick it to your chest and pretend you were playing. And those kinds of things were just experiments to come around the whole idea that we didn't have much access, but actually we could still learn.
What were some of the first sounds that you tried to make on the cello?
Oh, it's the first fascination was the C string, the low string, just the and having the instrument against you and that vibration was probably sound and love at first sight, you know. Stuff like that, you know, learning and like practicing and, you know, imitating and, you know, all that kind of world. And I thought, okay, there are two worlds now, but I have to make sure that they live in the same space.
To that end, there's quite a lot of singing on this album, throat singing, vocal clicks, overtones, like in the song Emmanuel. Mm-hmm. And oh, let's just play a bit so people can hear what I'm talking about here. When I first heard this, I honestly could not believe what I was hearing. How did you come to combine singing with the cello?
I always feel like if I don't sing, I feel very muted. You know, the way I view all of music is extremely malleable and fluid sonic spaces. Sound can be molded into anything and anybody, and I think that's the freedom that I fight for and I try to give myself and kind of get away from being a classical musician or being an African musician. They're both in my DNA. I'm an African person with African ideals, but those ideals are connected to the universalities of the world.
I wondered if you felt any tension between the improvisation and the classical.
Yeah. Tradition is something that is passed down. And expecting the people that you pass it down to do it exactly the same as you did it, you know, 100 years ago is impossible. And I think the acceptance that it will change in the hands of the young is incredible. The moving things about music that is so old is because it comes from a very long context of human life. So every time I play a classical piece, I say, this is the reason I'm playing it. I can really tell my story in many ways through classical music.
Well, to that end, you have a couple of classics of the solo cello repertoire, but they are transformed. There is your arrangement of a piece from the third suite of Marais that includes vocals. Dialogue do you think that you're having across time in this arrangement?
I love the fact that you say across time, you know, because I asked myself, you know, in the 1800s, what were my forefathers doing in a musical sense and what was happening in Europe? People were writing in mind with God and the church, and actually that was very much happening in South Africa too. The world of four-part harmony had landed already in pre-colonial thought, like amazing throat singing, you know, two notes at once. You know, Africans were already doing such incredible things with harmony.
Could you give me an example of throat singing, so just so people who don't know what we're talking about?
So this is a kind of low, you sing a normal note, hum, hum, hoi, hum, hoi, and you relax your throat. Hoi, oh, you, you, you.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've no training at all.
No.
That's crazy. Except home training. It's like home cooking, right?
Yeah.
You cook at home and
experiment on
your food is delicious, and if people they want to eat it, they can. If they don't, then
exactly. It's an encouragement to myself or anybody else who listens to my music to be themselves. You know, I think the expression of yourself is like the most important thing you can be. Being part of communities is great, but also being an individual is amazing. There's so much that's around you that you decide to put onto your fabric. And it's your choice what you decide to put on. And I think that's just one of the biggest human freedoms.
That is Abel Selaouchiwe. His new album is Hymns of Bantu. Before we let you go, what do you want us to hear on our way out? What shall we play?
I'll play you one of my favorite tunes about the strength of mothers. There's a saying in Sesotho that says, Mosari o tshwara thipa ka bohaleng. It says, a woman holds the knife on the sharp side. It's pretty raw stuff. And it basically speaks of their courage, their tenacity, you know, their patience. So it's kind of a celebration of them. Mosari o tshwara thipa ka bohaleng. Mosari o tshwara thipa ka bohale, hola.
This is NPR News.
At All Things Considered, what unites all our conversations is curiosity.
Is he a good hugger?
Whether we're speaking to an aid worker.
What would you want them to know or understand about what you all are dealing with?
A scientist.
But what's in it for the dolphins?
Or a foreign leader.
If I may, I will ask the questions.
By these right
I will ask the questions.
Questions and answers. Every day on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. It was 3 years ago today Russian forces began their full-scale invasion of Ukraine. At the White House this morning, French President Emmanuel Macron is presenting a European peace plan for Ukraine in talks with President Trump, as NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Macron is coming with a proposal of a European peacekeeping force in Ukraine to be led by Britain and France, Europe's two nuclear powers. He'll try to convince Trump that Russia is an existential threat for Europe and without strong guarantees would surely rebuild its forces and invade Ukraine again. Having British Prime Minister Keir Starmer repeat the same message when he meets with Trump on Thursday in Washington is a good idea, says Gesine Weber, security and defense analyst at the U.S.-German Marshall Fund.
It could be smart to have this sequencing of the visits to reinforce the message and potentially also adapt it and coordinate it.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has called any European troops on the ground in Ukraine a red line. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, says he'd be willing to resign in exchange for NATO membership or lasting peace in his country. Zelensky was speaking yesterday in Kyiv. The Vatican says Pope Francis remains in critical condition at a hospital in Rome. Doctors say blood tests show the 88-year-old pontiff is showing signs of mild kidney failure as he deals with double pneumonia. This is NPR News. Israeli forces will stay inside the Syrian Golan Heights and forbid the new Syrian army to enter areas south of Damascus. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made that announcement yesterday, demanding a complete demilitarization of the area, as NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports.
The Israeli government sent a defiant message to the new Syrian government, which is trying to consolidate power after the fall of the Assad regime last December. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israeli forces would remain in a buffer zone between the two countries for, quote, an indefinite time. In December, Netanyahu said the move would be temporary. The buffer zone is a ceasefire area patrolled by United Nations peacekeepers. Israeli forces moved into the area, as well as in some parts deeper inside Syria, almost immediately after the fall of the Assad regime. There was no immediate comment from the Syrian government. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
At least two passengers have filed lawsuits against Delta Airlines stemming from the crash landing of Flight 4819 at Toronto's Pearson International Airport a week ago. Everyone aboard survived. Starbucks says it's eliminating 1,100 corporate employees worldwide in an effort to streamline the coffee company's operations. Those being let go will be notified by tomorrow. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Israel says it has deployed tanks in the occupied West Bank. It's the first time tanks have been sent to the territory in more than two decades. And it comes as Israeli leaders say they have instructed the military to intensify what it calls a counterterrorism operation in the West Bank, an operation that has been going on for more than a month now and has displaced tens of thousands of Palestinians from their home. For more, we're joined by NPR's Kat Lawrence-Dorf. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So what can you tell us about the Israeli military operation in the occupied West Bank right now?
So these Israeli tanks have entered the Jenin refugee camp, which is where this current military operation started and has been a focus throughout. In the past month, the operation has spread to several other refugee camps. And you know, one thing to understand when we talk about these refugee camps is that they're built up urban areas with apartment buildings and family housing, schools, hospitals, infrastructure. They have long been militant strongholds, which is why Israel says it's focusing on them. But you know, they're also home to families and civilians. Yesterday, as tanks were entering, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz put out a statement saying that the Israeli troops will remain in the camps for the coming year, which is a big change in policy. He also said that the Israeli military will continue to, quote, clear refugee camps, and that the more than 40,000 Palestinians who have fled during this violence would not be allowed to return. Mm. Palestinian leaders firmly reject this and fear that this might allow for Israel to begin to annex parts of the West Bank.
So let's talk about the Palestinians who have fled. You were in Jenin last week and spent some time talking to displaced families. What'd you hear from them?
So this is the largest displacement of Palestinians in the West Bank in several decades. Many of those who are displaced are staying in rented apartments that are becoming increasingly unaffordable, but others are staying in makeshift shelters, you know, in schools or mosques or community centers. I talked to Sanaa Ashrim. She fled her home in the Jenin refugee camp with her family and one-month-old granddaughter weeks ago. They're now living in a school in a village outside the city. I'm so stressed, she told me. I keep asking, when can we go back? Ramadan is coming and I want to be home. You know, the holy month of Ramadan starts at the end of this week and people were hoping that they could go home for it. Now, with Katz's announcement, that really doesn't seem like a possibility.
Before I let you go, I do want to turn to the ceasefire in Gaza, which has been holding for more than a month. As part of that deal, this weekend, several Israeli hostages were released, and in return, more than 600 Palestinians were supposed to be freed from Israeli jails, but that's been delayed. What happened?
So Israel says this delay is because the hostage release ceremony on Saturday in Gaza was, quote, humiliating. Hamas had driven a pair of Israeli hostages who are still being held to the ceremony and then filmed them at the scene begging Israel to extend the ceasefire to allow for their release. It's not clear how long Israel is going to delay the release of the Palestinian prisoners and detainees, but Hamas has called this a violation of the ceasefire agreement.
Okay, so does that mean the ceasefire is in danger of falling apart now?
Well, it's certainly a concern. There is a scheduled return of hostage bodies from Gaza this Thursday. We're watching to see if that happens. The first phase of this deal is supposed to end this weekend, but Israeli and U.S. officials have talked about maybe extending it. Hamas would also need to agree to that. Meanwhile, Steve Witkoff, President Trump's Middle East envoy, is coming to the region later this week, you know, to participate in talks, which are going to be crucial to the future of the ceasefire.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
If you ordered coffee on a mobile app while scrolling your feeds this morning, this next story is for you. Researchers decided to find out what would happen to people's moods and attention spans if they turned off their smartphones. NPR's Allison Aubrey tells us how long it took to make a difference.
At a time when more than 90% of Americans have a smartphone, we tend to forget that having a supercomputer at our fingertips all the time is a new phenomenon. Adrian Ward is a psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin. He's in his late 30s, and he remembers having a dial-up connection.
When I was a boy, the internet, you know, we didn't have it at first, but then it lived in a room in our house, and you used it at specific times because you had limited minutes and had to make sure nobody else was on the phone line.
So what would it feel like to go back to those days when we didn't have constant connection to everything? He and his collaborators decided to find out. They recruited 467 participants who agreed to block the internet from their smartphones for 2 weeks. That means no social media scrolling, no streaming, no online shopping on their phones. And it turns out most people, 91% of the participants, seemed to feel better.
What we found was that people had better mental health, better subjective well-being, and better sustained attention.
For example, when participants were asked to perform a task to measure how long they could pay attention, they did better. And when it came to questions such as, how often in the past week have you felt little interest or pleasure in doing things, their responses pointed to a significant lift in mood. Ward says the study results suggest a reduction in symptoms of depression on par with what other studies have found with antidepressant medications.
Not saying it's the same as an antidepressant. Who knows how long-lasting this effect is, but that suggests that it's something worth looking into.
His hypothesis on what actually improves moods isn't about what was taken away from people. After all, they could still use computers at work or home, and they could talk on their phones. It has more to do with what they added back into their lives.
So it's not that you stop using the internet and magically you just feel better. It's that you do other things. And so people reported that they spent more time in nature, more time socializing, more time doing hobbies. They got more sleep.
They felt more socially connected. Dr. Judith Joseph is a psychiatrist and leads a Women in Medicine initiative at Columbia University. She says she's not surprised by the findings. Many people don't want to be tethered to their devices.
They know their phones are a problem. They just can't stop. So helping people to retrain their brain to derive joy from healthy places has an antidepressant effect. And that's why I'm not surprised.
A lot of the participants in the study found that they had to break the rules. For example, when they were in their cars and needed to use a map app for directions or log on to a Zoom meeting for work. It's a reminder of how dependent we've become. So even if you can't turn off the internet, Dr. Joseph recommends taking little breaks, beginning with baby steps.
Slowly over time, if you can do this, even for 30 minutes here, 20 minutes there, build up. Try to see if you can increase these increments on a weekly basis.
Or here's one idea to get started. If you go out for a walk after dinner, leave your smartphone behind and see how you feel. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public.
This is NPR News.
When the Supreme Court effectively ended affirmative action at colleges in 2023, many expected the enrollment of Black and Latinos to plummet. That's not exactly what happened. Next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. The cat's out of the bag at Gordon Ramsay's new London restaurant. 477 cats, actually. Ramsay opened a Japanese restaurant earlier this month, the latest in his lucky cat chain. The restaurant was full of Maneki Neko figurines. They're known as beckoning cats because the cats have a raised paw and they're considered good luck. But I guess someone thought they needed the luck more than this eerie and took almost 500 of them in just a week. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. From EasyCater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. A trial begins today for the man accused of opening fire on a July 4th parade near Chicago in 2022. The mass shooting happened in Highland Park, Illinois. Seven people were killed. Dozens more were wounded. Here's Anna Savchenka with member station WBEZ.
The July 4th parade had just started when a gunman fired more than 80 rounds into the crowd from a nearby rooftop. Diego Hernandez was at work, but his family was at the parade. When the shooting started, his young daughter called him. Here's what Hernandez said that day.
She called me and I'm hearing the shots through the phone. I'm just telling her to duck for cover and stay with her aunties and not to be looking around, not to, you know, my daughter's 9 years old. I don't want her seeing bodies on the floor, things that will traumatize a 9-year-old, you know?
Hernandez said his granddad was among the dead, but that he was still thankful for those who lived.
Like, don't get me wrong, it's heartbreaking. We did lose a family member, but like I said, it could have been worse. It could have been multiple. It could have been everybody.
Adam Sherman was also at the parade with his family. He says he still struggles with the memories of that day. Little things trigger him, like shooting scenes on TV, or when he visits his sister, who lives in Highland Park, and he passes by the spot where the shooting happened.
It's always that, like, feeling of, like, oh, that happened here.
Along with the seven people who lost their lives there, 48 others were injured, including a boy who was 8. He was shot in the back. He's now paralyzed from the waist down. A man named Robert Cremo III was arrested that same day, and prosecutors say he confessed to the shooting while in custody. Cremo was 21 at the time, and he didn't have a criminal record before the arrest. But in 2019, police went to his family's home and seized a collection of knives after a relative said Cremo had threatened to, quote, kill everyone. 3 months after that incident, Cremo successfully applied for a card required to own a gun. He went on to legally buy several guns, including the semi-automatic rifle he allegedly used in the shooting. Now, Cremo is facing more than 100 felony counts, including 7 counts of first-degree murder. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges.
In all reality, he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Doug Godfrey, a professor at the Chicago Kent College of Law, has been following Cremo's case, and he thinks the evidence against Cremo is overwhelming.
If you look at it from the defense angle, you have nothing to try. You know, he's made statements. He had the weapon. The prosecutor will have no problems meeting their burden.
If convicted, Cremo faces a maximum sentence of life in prison. Sherman, the shooting survivor, says that's the outcome he wants to see.
Justice would look like him having a punishment that fits this terrible crime and that he does not experience joy ever again.
A judge ruled that all 48 of the injured victims will be allowed inside the courtroom, even though many of them may be called as witnesses. Cremo himself has skipped several court appearances in the run-up to the trial, and the judge warned him last week. If he doesn't appear in court on Monday, the trial will go on without him. For NPR News, I'm Anna Savchenka in Chicago.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. There hasn't been a new daytime soap opera on a major television network for over 25 years until today. Beyond the Gates debuts on CBS and Paramount Plus this afternoon, replacing The Talk. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans visited the show's set in Atlanta to see how it's making history in another way by focusing on a wealthy black family.
All right, guys, we're moving on.
That will be Act 2, Scene 2. Act 2, Scene 2, everyone.
The atmosphere at Assembly Studios is friendly but firm, because the cast and crew of CBS's Beyond the Gates understand they have to get a lot filmed quickly, enough to fill an hour of daytime television every day. And one of the biggest challenges, as co-star Daphne Duplay discovers in one scene, is just remembering all the lines.
Ashley has no interest in you?
She straight up.
We're shooting for one take. Okay, let's one take and move on.
That's Tamara Tooney, who plays Anita Dupree, matriarch of the wealthy black family at the heart of Beyond the Gates. In addition to her work in films and TV shows like Law & Order Special Victims Unit, Tooney spent more than 15 years on the CBS soap opera As the World Turns. She has emerged as something of an unofficial coach for some actors who haven't worked on soap operas before, where they film a lot more material in one day than typical primetime TV dramas.
We're in Atlanta, where no one has really done daytime drama like this. And so it's a big learning curve.
Beyond the Gates is an ambitious effort. It's the first soap opera in nearly 35 years to focus on a black family from its start. It's centered on Tooney's Anita Dupree, a once famous singer married to retired Senator Vernon Dupree, played by Clifton Davis. Davis, who starred in TV shows like Amen and Madam Secretary, says he's excited to bring a new type of black family to television, living in a fictional suburb near Washington, D.C.
There are communities in the United States where African Americans are tremendously affluent. And it's those kinds of stories that we're suddenly touching on that haven't been really told before.
And CBS has leveraged lots of resources to make it all happen. There's a cast of 40 characters and about 200 people working on the show, which has 27 different sets.
We are on two stages, a total of 35,000 square feet. So it's large, but, you know, we could always use more space.
Sheila Duxworth, an executive producer on Beyond the Gates, walks through the show's various sets like a proud parent. She heads a production partnership between CBS and the NAACP, which has made Beyond the Gates its first project, inspired in part by her time watching soaps like ABC's General Hospital and NBC's Generations years ago.
Literally, that was one of the things that made me say, I want to do a soap opera that shows folks that look like us and do things like us and really, you know, kind of hang a lantern on the cultural aspects that I thought were missing in soaps.
Duxworth enlisted pioneering black soap opera veteran Michelle Valjean to create and write the show. And in a first for the soap world, many of the show's other department heads are black as well. Stevie Martin leads the show's makeup department.
When you see somebody that looks like you, it automatically creates the trust factor. We have the same skin tone or a variety of it, then I know you know what to look for and what to do and what not to do.
As Martin talks, she's working on actress Carla Moseley, who plays one of Vernon and Anita's daughters. Moseley, a veteran of soaps like The Guiding Light and The Bold and the Beautiful, says that trust can help actors deliver better performances.
It's so comforting because this is where you come first, right? Hair and makeup, yeah. You're sitting in these seats. Yeah. If you have a traumatic experience before you get on set, it's really hard to focus.
Soap operas have been in decline for years. There are only a few still on network TV now. Still, Duxworth cites statistics showing black women are an important part of daytime TV audiences. She hopes to win their loyalty with Beyond the Gates.
I think we all know that our grandmothers called them the stories and they got passed down. You grew up watching them and so you then watch them, and that is the hope for this soap too.
Davis says the show seems to be sending a message at a time when the Trump administration is going after federal diversity and inclusion efforts and corporations are backing away from them.
There's an effort to eliminate or erase or modify black history. It's important for us to keep making black history. That's what we're doing. We're adding on this end. You may be swiping us off on the back end, but we're still coming.
Seems the crew at Beyond the Gates isn't shy about making their own contribution to history. Eric Deggans, NPR News, Atlanta.
Black history is also made every day in communities across the country. We asked NPR listeners to tell us about heroic figures in their lives.
My name is Mary Beth Tassinari, and I'm from New Jersey. You know, every once in a while, you meet someone who completely shifts the way you see the world. For me, that person is Tony Bell. Tony runs the Heritage Civil Rights Tour, a six-day journey through history that takes people across six states and 25 historical sites. She sees young people go on this tour and come back changed. And Tony does it all with an optimism that I can't fully wrap my head around. And that makes her a hero in my book.
Hi, NPR. My name is Matt. I'm speaking from Melbourne, Florida. My local Black hero is a Cocoa Beach street musician who's making a difference by spreading love and positivity. This musician attracts you with his warm presence, and when his talent takes you over, he strikes with lyrics about equality. Look around and you'll find a Black person making history in every corner of this country. They might not be on a podium. They could be singing reggae with leaves tied to their hair and a precious smile on their face.
My name is Tiara. I'm from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and I want to recognize Jordan Blackbird Broyles. Jordan is a champion for community, connection, and literacy, which shows through his annual book drives for children all across our state. Thank you, Jordan, for making Black history in Oklahoma.
My name is Kathy Baxley, and I am the deputy mayor of the Village of Rockville Center on Long Island, New York. It is my honor to speak about Sharon Shepherd, one of the leaders of our Dr. Martin Luther King Community Center. She has started a teen mentoring program for girls, another program for children who learn how to cook healthy meals. Additionally, Sharon started a food pantry during COVID, which continues today. Sharon is a phenomenal person, and she gives back to the community unlike anyone else.
NPR listeners, on Black History Being Made Today. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.